I have four sessions this week, and they are around the theme of what it is that we might learn from Dietrich Bonhoeffer on issues that are important to us. They may not have been the burning issues for him, they are burning issues for us. So it's a look to this Lutheran theologian and pastor, lived his life in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, his mature life, of this century, for some clues for our thinking about critical issues. And the first of the issues for us, which happened also to be a critical issue for him in this case, is the matter of patriotism. And we'll be talking about that as a question which concerns us, and use his life and his thought as a kind of foil for our own considerations. There has certainly been a resurgence of patriotism. I suppose one could mark it with the election of Ronald Reagan, but it's an old theme. My father volunteered for service in the United States Navy in World War II. He was called Pop by the folks in his unit because he was one of the older ones. He left his wife and two small children to enter the armed forces of the United States. He just felt patriotic and felt that even at cost to himself and considerable anxiety on the part of my mother, and I suppose we children too, I was young at the time. I have recollections of him going, and I have vivid recollection of him returning safely. I also have a recollection of visiting him in Mississippi and burning my feet on the sidewalk. But to my father, it was rather compelling as a duty to nation that he do so. So patriotism wasn't invented with Ronald Reagan. It just had one of its most ardent salespersons. And we have had a resurgence of patriotism in this administration. You and I have seen the signs of it all over the place. I wonder how many companies have changed their advertising colors to red, white, and blue. It would be interesting just to put out the list. The used car lots that I go by now have Old Glory flying from the corner of the car lot, and the flags are about twice the size, three times the size of what they used to be. So there has been a real resurgence of patriotism. In the president's words, America is back and standing tall. Now, some of us overdosed on it, I think, at the time of the Olympics in Los Angeles, where the patriotism was strode out in the international arena with great gusto and really done up Hollywood style, to the enthusiasm of millions and millions of U.S. Americans.
You think 100 pianists playing?
100 pianists, that's right. Yes.
A little excessive.
Rhapsody
of Blue, I guess.
Yeah. Maybe coincidentally, and maybe Blue wasn't. I bring up this topic too, not only because it's been a resurgent one in our society, but because I doubt, despite the strong themes in American history, that religious patriotism has had a day like it has had. Religiously sponsored or religiously sanctioned or religiously sold and religiously believed patriotism has had the day that it has had. Again, we're talking about a theme with deep roots and considerable history here, but it is in some quarters almost standard dress to have a flag and the lapel on one side and a cross on the lapel on the other side. And even though PTL has now given something of a bad name to the old American style evangelism, nonetheless, nobody in those quarters with followings of millions and millions of people wants to disengage cross from flag. On the contrary, the motifs of a special place in God's world for the leadership of America is a place which is no one on the in the religious community, at least on the religious right, has wanted to downplay. And we have had, with the Reagan administration, a resurgence of the political right and the religious right, and where they come together is around the theme of patriotism. So that may be a kind of setting. Now, why is it an issue? Well, it's always an issue in ethics, in Christian ethics, but it's an issue for the whole country as well this time around. Some of you, maybe all of you, have taken in part of the Iran-Contra affair and the hearings. Oliver North, with a performance that is still being hailed and responded to affirmatively, was called by the president himself a hero at the time, that he was also asked to resign. And Oliver North's appeal has been largely the appeal of a patriot. He says at the same time that he did not believe, does not believe to this day, that he did anything wrong. But the real case is made that he was a soldier in the service of his country doing what he judged to be in the good of the nation. And rests his case there. And the response to Oliver North has been a response of affirmation to who is perceived to be a patriot. You should know, if you do not know also, and it's part of religious patriotism, that Oliver North is an active and devout Christian, that he and his wife are the regular hosts in their home to Bible study on Wednesday, and that he regards his service in the Marine Corps of the United States, and more importantly in the National Security Council until he resigned, as in keeping with what he, as a Christian and a patriot, is to do. Admiral Poindexter, again, whether or not, how it affects him, I'm not sure, because he hasn't been so articulate in other quarters about the relationship of his faith to his service and his patriotism, but Admiral Poindexter is married to an Episcopalian priest. I trust that there's some kind of connection between what he has seen to be his service as a patriot and to Christian faith. Nonetheless, that's, again, linking it up with Christian faith. It does raise the question that I want us to give special focus to, and that is, what is Christian patriotism? What qualification does that adjective give that noun? Does it give any other angle on an important issue for us? If you've been watching the Iran-Contra hearings, you also know that there have been great differences about what patriotism calls for. There was this dramatic moment when Senator Inouye responded to Oliver North's insinuations, according to Senator Inouye, that the patriotic course was the course he had been taking, and that those who disagreed with the course that had been taken were exhibiting a lack of love of nation. And Senator Inouye, whose people, Japanese Americans, were sitting in camps where the U.S. government had put them, Senator Inouye, at the very time that his people were in camps, lost his arm. in the war, serving in the armed forces of the United States. He had a different judgment than Lieutenant Colonel North about the present policies of the National Security Council and whether or not they were patriotic. But what is maybe most significant to notice through all of that, nobody wanted to be unpatriotic or appear to be so. That would have been to transgress commonly assumed understandings of what was good and what was right. So it's an issue. What is genuine patriotism is an issue for us. It has been a long-standing issue in this society. It is one of the classic issues in Christian ethics, and it comes to the fore not only well before Jesus, but becomes a crucial issue for the early churches. And then because it is so for us as U.S. Americans, and because from another source and another channel, it is so for us as holders of Christian faith, comes that question, what is Christian patriotism? I want to spend some time with the group offering some reflections and even just some descriptions of patriotism today before turning to, in essence, tell a story. I just want to tell a story later on, and that is the story of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. We'll continue tomorrow with more of the story and further discussion on the issue of patriotism. But let's just take some time now to check out what we see as the character of U.S. patriotism now. How would you describe it? I call to mind some images that of flags and the Olympics and religious apparel and other things. But how would you describe the resurgent patriotism? That is, what are its characteristics? How does it come across to you? Quite apart from how you might judge it, what's the nature of this patriotism? If Senator Inouye has one notion about what is good and proper for a patriot to do, and Oliver North has another notion of what is good and proper for a patriot to do, is that simply a difference of judgment, or are they talking about different kinds of patriotism? Let's just have some word pictures or some other short descriptions of what you see as the kind of patriotism that is now present. It's no doubt multi-dimensioned. What are some of the dimensions?
Exercise your voting rights.
Yeah. We're coming up on an election. It is proper to make our choices at that time. Sure.
Strong part of it seems to be my country right or wrong, which is very disturbing.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of an athletic
patriotism. By which you mean what, Jerry?
Well, I suppose I mean primarily the way in which the Super Bowl is the sort of that comes in and the congratulations to the winners and the trip to the White House.
That's right.
All from the White House to the dressing room.
Yeah, I'm a Mets fan. We got to get off the Super Bowl for a minute. Yeah. I'm a Mets fan. When the Mets won, yeah, the president called.
Yeah,
sure. Yeah.
As he should.
Yes. I agree with this gentleman. And that's interesting that professional sport has some part of this, and somehow it's supposed to carry over into how we view the country,
uh-huh.
Huh?
Athletic. Also, the way the dark side of the whole athletic thing is surfacing now, you know, in terms of Lenny Bias or Raphael Septien, or, you know, and child molestation and all of the drug abuse and the money and, you know, sort of reflects in there too. That what's very heroic is surrounded with a lot that's fairly tawdry.
Yeah, and that one, that is not only an issue then, if you make this identification somehow of sport, and especially professional sport, with the larger society in an affirmative way, then when that dark side shows up there, it is not only confined to sports,
right,
but somehow reflects on the society. Yeah.
The term manifest destiny gathers up some of the connotations for me. We're the most blessed, we're the most talented, and God has given us the highest responsibility for influencing the course of civilization.
Mm-hmm. When Luther Ludtke was here and did sessions at Holden in American Studies some years back, he included a series of taped interviews about what is the place of the United States, or as people just said for short, America. And one of the interviews was most interesting. We all recognized the voice, but he didn't tell us who it was. And it was Ronald Reagan. And Luther had interviewed Reagan at the time that Ronald Reagan was governor of California. But it was about as clear a statement of manifest destiny, and as Reagan has often said since, a special place in God's design for this nation. Yeah. That tape is no doubt in the tape library. Yeah.
What I never heard being brought up during those hearings was that if you trade, say, 1,000 missiles for X number of American hostages, say 6, 7,
mm-hmm,
and you can kill 1,000 Iraqis with those missiles,
mm-hmm,
are you then trading 1,000 lives in Iraq for 6 lives of United States citizens?
Yeah.
Which apparently are much more of value than those Iraqis.
Mm.
So we do put ourselves on that pedestal.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's a different standard of measurement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Instead of my country right or wrong, I think it's just my country right.
So, we're not entertaining another notion. Huh?
Well, I think in World War II, the veterans were all patriotic.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, the veterans of Vietnam were not considered anything.
One of the, I don't know if that, I mean, I'm sure that hasn't been resolved yet, the whole Vietnam era. Episode in our history. I've now moved to New York after teaching in Washington a while, and one of the events that happened in New York was a rather ragtag assemblage of Vietnam vets, now middle-aged, walking down the canyon of Lower Broadway, and people just heaving gently, but with much enthusiasm, confetti on them. And the emotion that was shown in the faces of those veterans was moving to everyone, partly because of the reason that you said there has been an ambivalence about our participation in the war and the soldiers who fought in that war, and as the nurses have reminded us, they were female as well as male, the soldiers who have fought in that war haven't had the place accorded them that the veterans of other wars, and that rather moving parade on Broadway was to many of them finally some respect that they hadn't seen elsewhere.
And that's not just the natural redress, but I think it's also part of what we're noting as a resurgent nationalism. You can see Oliver North again pictured in Vietnam, and coming out of that, the resolve that this kind of humiliation won't happen again.
Yes.
And even Peter Berger reversing his position,
coming
out with a very, very, you know, one resisting Vietnam, now coming out and saying, because we didn't finish the war, we did a greater ill than if we had done it right.
Yes.
And I think that our presence in Central America is reinforcing a reassessment of Vietnam. The right thing there would have been to go in strong and finish it.
That's part of Manifest Destiny, because that we're developing a new myth, like the German myth of the stab in the back. North said over and over again, people claiming that we didn't lose the war. America can't lose a war. We were forced to withdraw by craving politicians and people who didn't understand what was really happening.
Yeah, when
the counterpoint that's still out, that's out there is Platoon.
Oh.
Which I think has also had a wide receptivity precisely for its message of, from a vet's perspective, questioning who was the enemy.
Yes.
And the enemy was inside of us, we were. You know, so I think we've got different kinds of very powerful...
Which themes which aren't resolved yet, and issues which aren't resolved yet. It may turn out, and I don't know how this judgment would ever be fully demonstrated, that what we've seen with the Iran-Contra affair and the actions of Oliver North and Poindexter and others is a kind of refighting of the Vietnam War. This time we're going to do it. It needs to be done right. Never again, that humiliation. Yeah.
Never again. Patriotism and the protection of American lives was the reason with which we were told why those bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Mm.
And yet Truman's diaries and other information has revealed that the American decision to drop those bombs was more based on the intimidation of the Soviet Union and its later effect on Soviet-U.S. relations than the actual prevention of loss of Western lives. There's evidence that we're not, there is not much evidence that the protection of lives was the reason, that there may not have been a loss of any lives in terms of Japan was willing to surrender when the Soviet Union said they were going to enter. And the bombs were dropped just before the Soviet Union entered, therefore didn't enter. Those kinds of things, patriotism, to protect our lives has much more value and as a mask than the loss of those hundreds of thousands of Japanese lives. We hide behind a mask of patriotism.
Hmm. It's especially appropriate since tomorrow is remembrance of Hiroshima Day. Yeah. Oh, excuse me, Ruth. I thought I saw you put up your hand. Yes.
I think for me, Christian patriotism starts at home.
Uh-huh.
And it's my duty and responsibility to go to my caucus meeting, to express my opinions, to see that at the very grassroots level, Christian kinds of thinking and opinions are expressed. For me, on a local level, I am on a school board to see that we have the best possible education for our children, and yet in our schools we do teach as much ethics as possible, and make them as good as possible, make them as best citizens as possible. And also to write letters to my congressmen to tell them how I feel and how I think, because they do pay attention to letters. So while everybody else is talking here on a national level, I think Christian patriotism starts at home with me.
Yeah, thank you. And then to link that back to the first response about voting and elections. It's particularly disturbing when you have simultaneously a strong surge of almost unqualified confidence, or at least expression of support of leadership, coupled with very low participation in elections or other manifestations of people at the local level thinking and acting for themselves. It's a much healthier patriotism when you've got folks who are engaged locally and take their civic duties very responsibly. I mean, we've had a falling level of participation in national elections over many elections now, and Ronald Reagan was elected with a considerable majority of the votes cast by only 29% of the eligible voters in this country.
And for me, by the time you're getting to vote in your national election, it's much too late.
Yeah.
It has to start.
That's another
on the
at home there as a double reference, both your community and in your household, how kids are brought up. I find one positive development in the national concern now about the state of moral health or lack of health in this society, where there is a willingness to talk about moral education and moral development in schools, but it yet doesn't yet quite get to the attention that it needs to be given in the home itself. But at least that's a conversation that people are willing to bring up now. It's something that you would not have expected from the U.S. Department of Education to give two full volumes of its official publication, its official journal, to the whole issue of moral education and moral development. Other comments about the kind of patriotism that you see, the varied dimensions of it. Yeah. Oh yes, and there we can't make up our mind either. I mean, on the one hand, there's a surge of support for protectionism in various forms. On the other hand, our economic patriotism has its rhetoric in the free enterprise and free trade camp. So we're not quite sure about which way to go on that. Many times we'll use the rhetoric to cover up for the other one, and we'll proceed with it. Okay, let me start to tell the story of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And I not only invite your questions of information for many details that I may overlook, and you want to know about something that I haven't passed along, I also invite your attention to those themes that you hear from Bonhoeffer's patriotism, which would set up a conversation with us. I do not believe that there is a transfer in any easy way from one time and place and one set of characters in the human historical drama to another time and place and another set of characters. I don't think we can say Dietrich Bonhoeffer shows us what Christian patriotism is for us as U.S. Americans. What I do believe is that you have a life and a setting rich with issues, perspectives, rich in human drama, that sets up a conversation with us, much as biblical materials do, and brings us into a perspective that we wouldn't have come to of our own accord because we're so immersed in the ethos of it. We need people who lived at different times and different places who then let us see our own reality in a different light. And that is what the story of Dietrich Bonhoeffer has to offer, rather than it being a story of imitation. Bonhoeffer is a particularly appropriate figure for this issue, because Bonhoeffer was a genuine Christian patriot. I mean, I think it's safe to say, with his biographer, Eberhard Bethge, that Bonhoeffer died as a Christian, for Germany. He died fully identified with his nation's fate, but he did so out of his faith and from his faith. So, the two words, if you will, Christian and patriot, go together in his life. Okay. I'll start at the end, the last days of his life, and then return to the beginning, his home, and the atmosphere there, And then we'll get as far as about 17 June 1940, and I'm going to stop on the 17th of June. You'll have to come back tomorrow to figure out why that's such an important day and what the next 5 years brought. So we'll get to 17 June 1940. One of the last fragments in Bonhoeffer's writings is a poem. It is a poem entitled The Death of Moses. It is a poem written in prison. He had no idea that you and I would gather here to listen to any of it. It wasn't written for anybody but his own meditation, and once in a while he wrote poetry for as gifts for friends, but he had no idea that we would be looking at it. So it was a kind of poem with which he identifies and is written only for his, clarifying who he is and what he's about. It's called The Death of Moses, and the last stanza is as follows. To punish sin and to forgiveness, you are moved. God, I have loved this people. That I bore its shame and sacrifices and saw its salvation, that is enough. Bonhoeffer's picture here is, in The Death of Moses, a picture of Moses standing atop Mount Nebo. Moses can see the Promised Land, but Moses cannot enter. And on the top of that mountain, he will die. Yet it's Bonhoeffer rather than Moses who is speaking in the stanza, even though he casts this in the words of Moses. The plot on Hitler's life has failed. Bonhoeffer has to reckon now with his own death at the hands of Hitler. God, I have loved this people is Bonhoeffer's voicing his love for Germany. It is not God, I have loved this people, meaning the church, that's also true in his case, but God, I have loved this people, that I have borne its shame and its sacrifices, the German people's sacrifices, and seen its salvation. That is enough. Now I can die, even though I will not enter the promised land. It's an expression of patriotism. But the patriotism isn't, in the first instance, simply in the poetry. It's in the life and actions of Bonhoeffer. He could have left Germany in the 1930s. Twice he did. He went to England one time and to the United States. In each case, he felt compelled to return. First in 1935, to direct the underground seminary of the Confessing Church, a church that was in opposition to Hitler. He was called back from England to direct the underground seminary at Finkenwalde. Then in 1939, he went to the United States, and at Union Seminary, where I teach, we have a room and called now the Bonhoeffer Room, because it was in that room that he made the decision in 1939 that he simply could not live the life of a refugee. He could not come to the United States and stay there, because he was too closely identified in his sense of responsibility for what was happening in his nation. And so 6 weeks after he came to the United States through the help of Reinhold Niebuhr and Paul Lehmann and other people at Union Seminary, he in that room decided, my hopes and my responsibilities are with my people, and my people are the Germans. And so he returned, knowing that he would get more deeply involved with other members of his family in the opposition to Hitler. He explained his decision in a letter to Reinhold Niebuhr, his teacher of his and a theologian and ethicist at Union. And in Niebuhr's recollection, the letter went like this. I have come to the conclusion that I have made a mistake in coming to America. I must live through this difficult period of our national history with the Christian people of Germany. I will have no right to participate in the reconstruction of Christian life in Germany after the war if I do not share in the trials of this time with my people. And near the end of his life, he said exactly the same thing. This one was written in a Christmas letter in 1943. Bonhoeffer was hanged at Flossenbürg on the 9th of April in 1945, but he was jailed a couple of years before that. And he wrote this letter to Eberhard Bethke, his best friend and now his biographer. Now I want to assure you that I haven't for a moment regretted coming back in 1939, nor any of the consequences either. I knew quite well what I was doing, and I acted with a clear conscience, and I regard my being kept here, and here means in Tegel prison, I regard my being kept here as being involved in Germany's fate. I don't look back at the past and accept the present reproachfully. All we can do is live in assurance and faith, you out there with the soldiers and I in my cell. Well, that's to begin at the end. I just wanted to make it clear from Bonhoeffer's own hand that he saw himself as a Christian patriot who fully identified with Germany's fate. But let's start at the beginning, because the story starts not there. The story starts elsewhere. Charles Dickens once said that it is in the love of home that love of country has its rise. And the most casual reading of letters from prison and the earlier correspondence reflects for Bonhoeffer an extraordinary family life. Some of you may be interested in looking at the farewell letters of the Bonhoeffer family. They're now published in English. They're called Farewell Letters of Resistance, as I recall. Fortress Press just published them. They are the letters of different members of the Bonhoeffer family, as one after the other was put to death for involvement, a patriotic involvement, in Germany's fate. But you will not only see in those letters a statement of who they are and the caring for one another as family, you will see reflected in there an extraordinary family ethos that was steeped in liberal German culture. With his family as a whole, Bonhoeffer felt himself from his childhood as somehow a guardian of German culture, somehow responsible for preserving the best that Germany had to offer. It was when Hitler came to power in 1933, the family gathered, the immediate family, it was a large one, seven kids as I recall, and Karl Bonhoeffer, the father, says, Hitler means war. And from the very onset, the family saw Hitler as the barbarization of things German, as a criminalizing of a great cultural legacy. And the Bonhoeffers themselves felt themselves to be responsible for the best that Germany had to offer. And Bonhoeffer, who was only 22 at the time when he wrote, gave a speech in Barcelona, he was doing his internship for the Lutheran Church. He did it in a Lutheran congregation in Barcelona. Gave a talk and he said, "For what I am, I thank this nation, Germany. Through this nation, I became what I am." But it was the parental home that tendered the national heritage to him, that nurtured the legacy for which he felt himself responsible, and that nurtured a loyalty to it. If, however, it was the Bonhoeffer home that was the nest so to speak, of Bonhoeffer's patriotism. It was Bonhoeffer's travels abroad that left a very distinctive mark on his patriotism. And I ask you to listen very closely to what's going on with Bonhoeffer as he travels. There were many trips. He came from a family that was privileged. They were upper middle class. His father was a very prominent university professor. There were two schools that you went to in those days if you wanted to get in on the budding science of psychiatry. One school was the University of Berlin, and Karl Bonhoeffer held the chair in psychiatry there. The other school that was a budding one was some fellow off in Vienna that folks sometimes went to see by the name of Sigmund Freud. Anyway, they lived in privileged quarters. The family did. They were not rich, but they regarded themselves as the bearers of the bourgeois culture associated with socioeconomically privileged strata in the society. And so the kids all traveled a lot as part of their education. Dietrich went to Rome during his university days. There was a trip that he made across the Mediterranean with his brother Klaus from Rome to North Africa, to Libya to be exact. Then there was another time, a year in Spain for a seminary internship. Then Klaus met him again. They went to North Africa, to Morocco, to New York for theological studies. And during that year, like good students do during January break, found an old rickety car and drove it till it finally died in Mexico. A trip to Cuba while he was doing studies at Union. In London for 2 years, although that was a job as a pastor in the German-speaking congregations, 1932 to 1934. Back to New York in 39 for that short 6 weeks that I told you about. And then during the war, trips to Sweden, to Denmark, to Norway, and to Switzerland on duty either for the church ecumenical movement or in the service of resistance, or as in most cases, both. The family nurtured a cosmopolitan disposition among all the children. The family nurtured a curiosity about all things unknown among the children. And Paul Lehmann, Dietrich's close friend at Union Seminary, put it nicely in a collection of and called I Knew Dietrich Bonhoeffer, that it was Bonhoeffer's habit, quote, to focus on what was most remote from his previous experience. And you see that all over in Bonhoeffer's life. You see a person who, from his parental home, was nurtured in such a way that he sought to go to the margins of his own experience to see life on terms indigenous to someone else and to rethink who he was in light of going to the margins of his own previous experience. I'll tell you later why I think that's so important for Christian patriotism and why we as U.S. Americans fail miserably in our own patriotic duty to do the same. Frank Bonhoeffer knew nothing of Black American culture when he came to Union Seminary. He immediately made friends with the Black students at Union and became a close friend of Frank Fisher, who introduced him to Harlem. And Bonhoeffer ended up actually teaching Sunday school in Abyssinian Baptist Church on 135th Street in Harlem. He went into a restaurant one time with Frank Fisher and the folks in the restaurant, New York City, 1930-31, would not serve him because he was in the presence of a Black. Bonhoeffer was incensed. He picked as one of his theme papers to do for Reinhold Niebuhr a long essay on theological interpretation of Black American literature. It's an example of what he had been taught to do to, at home. Go to the places that are marginal to your own experience. Understand it in its own terms as best you can, and relocate yourself in light of what you understand. Total stranger to pacifism. Anybody know any German in the 20s and 30s who was an ardent pacifist? He became close friends with Jean Lasserre, French pacifist studying at Union. You know anybody among the Germans in the 20s and 30s that wanted to be close friends with any Frenchman? Much less a French pacifist? Lasserre opened up pacifism and opened up international friendship, if you will. Now remember, the Germans are stinging from the Treaty of Versailles. And Hitler will use that as a stab of the back, related to Jews. But the Treaty of Versailles was total national humiliation for the Germans. Versailles. Jean Lasserre, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, close friends. Bonhoeffer learns what it's like to be a Frenchman, and a Christian pacifist, new to him. At home in Berlin, he moved out of his parental home in Grunewald. Grunewald is a nicer, not a suburb, it's in the city, but a nicer section of Berlin. He moved out of that when he taught the confirmation class in Wedding. Wedding is in the north of Berlin. It's a workers', still is, a workers' region, poor people. Bonhoeffer thought, if I'm going to teach the kids in my confirmation class about Christianity, I've got to know what it is, where they live. That's not my life in Grunewald. So he took an apartment in Wedding and had the kids up there, and he just moved into the neighborhood in order to understand it better. Even the journeys that didn't materialize for Bonhoeffer show this same mark. He sought and he received an invitation from Mahatma Gandhi. Now I never, just before the boat left from England for India, Bonhoeffer had to cancel out on that invitation because the call came for him from the Confessing Church in Germany to head up the underground seminary at Finkenwalde. But the reasons for his interest in Gandhi were utterly intriguing for a German in the 1930s. One, to learn resources from the East for a spiritually impoverished West. Two, to practice the arts, learn the arts of disciplined communities, the ashram experience, as a model for Christian community. And three, to study the ways of nonviolence as a practical social force. Know any Germans in the 1930s that were interested in nonviolence as a practical social force? It wasn't because Bonhoeffer wasn't German, it was because his home had nurtured him to seek in other people's experiences at the margins of his own that which might be of service to him as a German. It was a patriotic impulse. I am responsible for German culture. We Bonhoeffers bear the best of German society. And we must learn, as part of that, what we can from others in order to be better Germans. All right. Finally, in this experience of going to the margins in order to come relocate the center, I read you from a Christmas essay that he wrote as a gift to fellow conspirators. He, if you don't know the end of this story, well, you have to come back tomorrow. But he wrote a Christmas essay to fellow conspirators, and he wrote of the many things that they had learned together in 10 years of resisting Adolf Hitler and 10 years of resisting, even more importantly than Hitler as an individual, Nazism. He writes this from prison, but it was smuggled out for his co-conspirators. One paragraph. There remains an experience of incomparable value. We have for once learned to see the great events of world history from below, from the perspective of the outcast, the suspects, the maltreated, the powerless, the oppressed, the reviled. In short, we have learned to see world history from the perspectives of those who suffer. The important thing is that we should have come to look with new eyes at matters great and small. We have to learn that personal suffering is a more effective key, a more rewarding principle for exploring the world in thought and action than is personal good fortune. Bonhoeffer had explored the world from the point of view of personal good fortune. That had been his lot. The people in the resistance with whom he worked were, in fact, from the same bourgeois circles that Bonhoeffer, privileged, socially privileged circles that Bonhoeffer himself came from. Many were members of his family, but others were generals and were judges and were academics. They happened to work with others, socialists and communists who came from working class ranks. But Bonhoeffer says, what we have learned in this 10 years of resistance is that because we have become those who are among the suffered, and because we have understood now what is happening to the Jews, etc., that we have come to see the world anew. And it is a more rewarding principle for understanding the world to understand it from the point of view and experience of suffering. It tells more truth than does understanding the world from the point of view of personal good fortune. That was a marginal experience for Bonhoeffer, to be among the oppressed, to be a victim. And he's just, again, carrying up this theme, that what he learned there, he learned for Germany, and all of those foreign experiences, as well as that experience of resistance, was somehow or another for him a kind of training in responsibilities as a Christian and as a patriot. Okay, I want to get through one more segment, and then it'll be time to close. I'm going a little stronger today on a biography and spending a little more time telling the story than I will tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll finish the story, the short part of it, and then re-engage the question, what is Christian patriotism, with an eye to our circumstances. So please bear with me today as I get a little more of the Bonhoeffer story out as a basis for our discussion. Here the matter gets intriguing. It was intriguing before, but now you get Bonhoeffer deliberately thinking about the issue of patriotism, not just absorbing it from home and carrying out the character of one nurtured by a family to seek the experiences of others in order to learn responsibility as a patriot. Here Bonhoeffer starts thinking about where his loyalties lie and what they are to his nation. That came about because of Bonhoeffer's involvement in the 1930s in the ecumenical movement. Now, the ecumenical movement was just getting going the first four decades of this century. The World Council of Churches wasn't established till 1948, but the predecessor movements were happening in the 20s and 30s and then caught up by the war more slowly in the 40s. But Bonhoeffer was one of those who was involved, typically, in these experiences of a cosmopolitan character. And his involvement was a double one. It happens, and you have to understand what's happening at home for him in order to understand what's happening in the ecumenical movement. At home, in Germany, what was happening in the 20s, in the 30s now, early 30s, was a deepening church struggle. The so-called German Christians, Deutsche Christen, the religious right, if you will, trumpeted an acculturated faith, as they said, that the German way of life and the Christian way of life merge. And so they said, we Deutsche Christen, we German Christians, need to give our support to the rising movement in this nation, which was identified with Hitler. And it was a resurgent economy, and it was a resurgent nationalism. Germany was back and standing tall. And we Deutsche Christen need to support that, because the German way of life and the church and the Christian way of life share common ground. Now, some people sought, most of them were Lutherans, to be neutral and say churches needs to stay out of politics on that. We proclaim the gospel properly and we celebrate the sacraments properly, and that's what church is to do. So that was the neutral group. And then the third group was the so-called confessing church. It was first a confessing movement within the larger church, and then it broke away, and at Barmen and after in 1934, well before the war, it became a confessing church with its own institutional grounds, and they couldn't any longer collect the tax, church taxes for support, had to use free will offerings, had set up its own seminaries and so on. Okay, so it's Bonhoeffer's involvement in the deepening church struggle. Where will the church align itself now in the growing nationalism and the resurgent patriotism of the nation? Bonhoeffer, during this period of time, for your own reading, you ought to know that he was working on what became a kind of tract for the times. He didn't write it as a book, really. He worked on and off from 32 to 37 in a book that you know as The Cost of Discipleship, which reflects this church struggle. We Lutherans have gathered like eagles round the carcass of cheap grace, and there we have drank the poison that has killed the life of following Christ. Now, the other arena of passionate engagement for Bonhoeffer at this time is the international oikumene, the ecumenical movement. Later, when his participation had come to an end because he was jailed, he wrote that the ecumenical movement had become the basis for my whole life and thought. Now, it had become that, but it's not clear what his patriotism had to do with this movement, because it seems like Bonhoeffer now, when he gets into the ecumenical movement, subordinates his national citizenship to church identity and church citizenship. Bonhoeffer and his first identity now becomes church and then Germany. And he says so right out loud. He says, loyalty to the nation must become relativized to our membership in the transnational reality of the Church of Jesus Christ. The body of Christ is a concrete international reality. Listen to a sermon from 1934. The sermon is entitled The Church and the Peoples of the World. And he says, the Church of Christ lives at one and the same time in all peoples, beyond all boundaries, whether national, political, social, or racial. Racial is an important word here. And those who make up this church are bound together more inseparably than people are bound by all ties of common history, of blood, another important word, of class, and language. All these ties, which are part of our world, are valid ties. They're not indifferent, but in the presence of Christ, they are not ultimate bonds. That meeting in 1934, where he says national loyalty and membership is totally relativized and subordinate to membership in the body of Christ, that meeting was called to discuss whether the international church was empowered to take sides in international disputes, and the lengths that the church might go in international disputes and what actions are proper for it. Due to no small influence of Bonhoeffer at that meeting, the prime issue was peace. These are the years when the clouds of war are gathering, and when there's this resurgent nationalism in many quarters, not least of all in Germany. And I'll just read you one paragraph from this issue of peace, because I think it's rather eerie in its relevance now 50 years later. Bonhoeffer says in the same sermon, "How does peace come about? Through a system of political treaties? Through the investment of international capital in different countries? Through the big banks? Or through universal peaceful rearmament in order to guarantee peace? Through none of these, for the single reason that in all of them peace is confused with safety. There is no way to peace along the way to safety, for peace must be dared. It is the great venture." Moreover, Bonhoeffer continued, "Christians dare not take up arms against one another, for in so doing they take dead aim at Jesus Christ himself." Now that feeling about involvement in the ecumenical movement and his transfer of membership, the citizenship, to the body of Christ is an international reality, continued to the end. The last message that we have from Dietrich Bonhoeffer came by way of a fellow prisoner who happened to survive in the concentration camp, Payne Best, and Payne Best carried a message from Bonhoeffer to George Bell, Bishop of Chichester, who was an English bishop and a close friend of Bonhoeffer's. And Bonhoeffer says, told Payne Best to tell his dear friend, George Bell, that for me, this is the end, but also the beginning. With him, George Bell, I believe in the principle of our universal Christian brotherhood, which rises above all national interests, and our victory is certain. Okay, I wanna finish now, since our time is up, only by taking note of something, and we'll probably have to come back to this tomorrow. At the same time that Bonhoeffer's loyalty now is to church first and Germany second, you know what he did in all those meetings? He argued for a sympathetic hearing for Germany's real issues and problems. He was delighted when George Bell could distinguish between Germans and Nazis, or between the best of German culture and what was happening to it. He was in deep trouble in the ecumenical movement because he had to take up positions, even for the confessing church, which would not be understood as patriotic back in Germany. The ecumenical movement was deeply suspect in Germany. And in fact, Bonhoeffer lost his right to teach at the University of Berlin because of his involvement in the ecumenical movement. They were deeply suspicious of this. I should maybe just close by letting you know that the confessing church itself did not want itself to be seen, and Bonhoeffer was representing it in these circles, as anti-communist and as unpatriotic. And the ecumenical movement itself was seen, because it involved members from all nations, was seen to be suspect